Good afternoon. Welcome to the 416th gathering of the Mid-Coast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests who are here today, and to those who are hearing us through our public stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from Point Lookout in Northport, Maine, and I'm George Look, president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 to promote study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies. We are now in our 35th year, soon to be our 36th, of monthly meetings featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of U.S. foreign policy. Details about past and upcoming forum programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. For our meeting today, we are very pleased to have with us Ambassador Sarah Mendelson, who will be speaking to us on human trafficking 2.0. an area where she has extensive expertise and experience. Ambassador Mendelson is a distinguished service professor of public policy at Carnegie Mellon University and the head of Carnegie Mellon's Heinz College in Washington, D.C. From October 2015 until January 2017, she served as a U.S. representative to the Economic and Social Council at the United Nations, one of the five U.S. ambassadorial positions at the UN. In that position, Sarah Mendelson was the U.S. lead on United Nations efforts on international development, human rights, and humanitarian affairs. Her duties included leading efforts to elevate the issue of combating human trafficking within the UN. She also was the lead for President Obama's summit on refugees in September of 2016. Prior to her appointment as ambassador, she served from 2010 to 2014 as Deputy Assistant Administrator at the U.S. Agency for International Development, where she led efforts on democracy, human rights, and governance. Ambassador Mendelson has spent over two decades working on development and human rights issues, including in Moscow with the National Democratic Institute, on the faculty of the Fletcher School at Tufts University, and as a senior advisor and inaugural director of the Human Rights Initiative at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in London. She is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the author of over 70 scholarly and public policy publications. Ambassador Mendelson received her bachelor's degree from Yale University and her PhD in political science from Columbia University. Sarah, welcome to the Mid-Coast Forum.
Thank you so much. It is great to be with Midcoast Forum. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you, George and Karen Look, for hosting us. It's great to be back in Maine. Today, I'm going to walk you through answers to five basic questions about human trafficking. First, what is human trafficking? I'll refer to human trafficking using also the acronym TIP, which stands for Trafficking in Persons, and is used by many in the U.S. government. What is being done to combat human trafficking internationally, with a particular focus on what the U.S. government has been doing over the last 18 years? What have I done to combat human trafficking, both as a scholar and a practitioner? What more should be done? And finally, what can you do? I hope to motivate you all to take action. So, what is human trafficking? Maybe some of you have read about human trafficking in newspaper articles, or have seen movies like Taken or The Whistleblower, both of which do a very good job depicting the kind of violence that is inherent in TIP. The good news is there is an agreed upon definition of TIP that has been ratified by 173 countries and is referred to as the Palermo Protocol. So trafficking is an international crime involving the acquisition of a human being through the use of force, fraud, or coercion for the purpose of exploiting the individual for profit through forced labor or prostitution. And far from being a soft issue, trafficking, a modern-day form of slavery, constitutes a violation of human rights in which victims are deprived of their fundamental freedoms. This force, fraud, or coercion often has both violent and psychologically abusive aspects, including threatening to harm one's loved ones. So if you escape, we're going to get your parents or your children. Trafficking is generally thought of as an international crime that involves crossing borders, but trafficking victims can also be trafficked within countries. Traffickers can move victims between locations within the same country and often sell them multiple times to other trafficking organizations. Now, trafficking comes in different forms. There's trafficking for forced prostitution, or what is called sex trafficking. If minors are involved in any sort of prostitution, it's considered sex trafficking because those under 18 cannot be considered to have given consent. Now, forced labor often involves debt bondage. You've agreed to go somewhere, you think you're going to be earning money, but you have such a huge debt to pay off that you're never able to get out of this cycle. It could involve domestic servitude. You, again, think you're going somewhere, you're going to be paid very low wages. Again, you might have a debt bondage situation, and you're working constantly. You're working 18, 20 hours a day, and you're barely being paid. Child soldiers is a form of trafficking. It's important to understand that what is not trafficking. Smuggling, which involves consent, is not trafficking. You've asked to be smuggled somewhere. Although migrants who have consented to be smuggled are often at a heightened risk of being trafficked. So how prevalent is this issue? How prevalent is human trafficking? What do the numbers look like? And how much money is being made? According to the United Nations, this is very big business. It's a major part of international crime. It generates upwards of $150 billion a year. Keep that number in mind when you consider how much money we're spending as a US government to combat human trafficking. Now, the numbers of victims vary, as is the case often for criminal and hidden crimes. It's difficult to have precise numbers. Let me give you a sense of where those numbers lie. For a very long time, the US government has used the number 21 million victims a year. More recently, some experts, and to a certain extent the US government, has upped that number to nearly 40 million. Even if the number were half of that or a quarter of that, you can see this is a large problem. Now, key debates in the community cover issues such as, should we focus more on sex trafficking or labor trafficking? Are there more women and children involved versus men? How do we close the data gaps? What really works in terms of prevention? And we'll turn back to some of that shortly. So let's consider some examples of trafficking in persons. Forced labor, which happens inside the United States. This is a case that came after Hurricane Katrina. An organization called Signal International brought 50 Indian workers to the United States to work as welders and pipe fitters after the hurricane. These folks were promised green cards, and they were charged very high fees, again, this debt bondage, instead forced to work for low wages and lived in man camps with 24 men housed together in double-wide trailers. This was a successfully prosecuted case that led to a $20 million lawsuit. There's also sex trafficking, a case involving a minor initially in the United States. And this is a common occurrence. You have a child, in this case, a young girl named Amy. Her father was an alcoholic. He was abusing her physically and sexually. She wants to get out of the house. At 17, she moved in with a friend who connected her with a, quote, modeling agent, somebody who was going to help her get a better life. Instead, the man forced Amy into prostitution and locked her in a hotel room for weeks. Now, you hear a lot about North Korea in terms of nuclear weapons, but you should understand that North Korea has a booming business where it farms out workers and states pay North Korea money. In the case of Russia, this has been going on since Stalin's time. Approximately 20,000 citizens from North Korea go to Russia annually to labor in a variety of sectors, mostly logging in the Far East. They reportedly have only 2 days of rest per year, and they face punishment if they fail to meet production targets. And you can understand North Korea is under a sanctions regime from the UN. Cash that is flowing to North Korea in any form is in violation of those sanctions. There's domestic servitude. What's very interesting is that occasionally this domestic servitude involves not just criminal groups or criminal states. It may, and this was a surprise to many, involve foreign diplomats. There have been trafficking cases that have involved diplomats from Qatar, Bangladesh, Saudis, Kenyans, and others. And we can talk about whether or not immunity applies or not. As I said, child soldiers and debt bondage are also an aspect. So by now, you must be thinking, well, who's doing anything about human trafficking? Let me tell you about how the US government has engaged over time to combat human trafficking. This is a story that really goes back to the late 1990s and 2000. It's a bipartisan story, and one which involves the executive branch playing a role through then-President Clinton's Interagency Council on Women, which advocated an approach to combat trafficking that came to be known as the three Ps: prevention, protection for victims, and the prosecution of traffickers. It involved First Lady Hillary Clinton, who was extremely involved in getting legislation on the Hill. Now, those three Ps, the prevention, protection, and prosecution, were all synced up with that definition that I started with, the Palermo Protocol. The Palermo Protocol, in turn, was shepherded through with a lot of help from DOJ lawyers. In fact, a DOJ lawyer who went on eventually to become the ambassador at large to combat human trafficking under President Obama, Lou Sedabaca. But it's also a story that involves a critical role for Congress. The same year the Palermo Protocol was adopted, the U.S. adopted the 2000 U.S. Trafficking Victims Protection Act, the TVPA. It's been reauthorized a number of times, and I'm going to ask you to call your members of Congress at the end of the meeting to ask them to reauthorize. When we talk about it being reauthorized, there's an R that comes in there, and it's the TVPRA. Both the U.S. and international definitions emphasize the use of force, fraud, or coercion to obtain the services of another person. So Congress, with this legislation, the TVPA, established an office in the State Department to monitor and combat human trafficking that was to be led by a Senate-confirmed ambassador at large. That office was also charged with issuing a report annually to the world each year, the TIP report, as we call it, typically comes out in June. That TIP report monitors countries' progress in combating TIP. We'll get back to that in a minute. I want to talk a little bit about the three Ps or the four Ps. Now, as Secretary of State, Secretary Clinton and the State Department in 2009 added a fourth P, partnership, because it was long recognized this work is not to be done by governments alone. It's not to be done by only one country. Partnership is absolutely critical. Now, when I was preparing to come up to Maine back in June before our flights were canceled because we think American Airlines' system was hacked, before that, I noticed that the fourth P, partnership, had been deleted on the State Department's trafficking webpage. Despite the fact that the fourth P has been deleted, partnership continues to be critical. Now, let me walk you through prevention, what prevention means. This is really about raising awareness so that people know what trafficking is. This is important for the private sector because of supply chains. It's critically important for the tourist industry because a lot of people are actually trafficked through trains and planes. It's extremely important for the hospitality industry, and many, including Hilton, have been first movers. It's obviously important for first responders who come upon trafficked victims. For anyone who can help identify and help rescue or support trafficking victims, such as social workers, healthcare professionals, police, and humanitarian aid staff. And I will tell you there on the humanitarian aid staff, there's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of training that hasn't taken place and needs to be taken place. There's a very large and welcome focus recently around advocating and monitoring supply chains for goods. And again, this is where consumers come in. We all have the power of the pocketbook. Protection. The protection of trafficked persons is the cornerstone of a victim-centered approach. And according to international frameworks, a trafficked person is entitled to a number of rights. Certain rights including shelter, security, access to a broad range of services, and where appropriate, immigration relief. Trafficking victims in the United States, if they're willing to testify against the trafficker, are eligible for T visas. Protection programs focus on the identification of trafficked persons and the development of national and regional referral mechanisms that ensures survivors are provided shelter, food, counseling, legal assistance, as well as reparation or reintegration. Prosecution, we'll be going back to this again in a second. We have found over the years very low rates of TIP prosecutions, even lower rates of convictions globally. There's an enormous justice gap. If we have numbers of millions of people trafficked, we have less than 20,000 prosecuted. According to the State Department's TIP global law enforcement data, the number of trafficking prosecutions and convictions is significantly smaller than the number of victims identified, and it's minuscule compared to the estimated number of TIP victims. This is why I think partnership, the fourth P, is so important. The bottom line is we need to truly broaden constituencies that know about this issue and are engaged in stopping it. Who needs to be engaged? Local, national, regional, and global networks, civil society, universities, government, the private sector, labor unions, media, and faith-based organizations. In other words, it's an all hands-on-deck issue. I'm very proud of colleagues at Carnegie Mellon University who are using their tech know-how to do data mining, to find patterns and correlations, and working with law enforcement to target traffickers. There are online tools that they've developed to ID these traffickers. They're using machine learning, and it's called Traffic Jam. So now, initially when the Trafficking Protection Act was authorized, the authors of this legislation, some very, very smart staffers then working for Congress, they envisioned standing up an office at the State Department headed by an ambassador at large, as I described, who would oversee a report each year that ranked countries by tiers. They thought this would be a one-page sheet. It has evolved into a several hundred page book that is issued each year. It has become an extremely important diplomatic tool for a number of reasons. It's had a major impact on countries that care about their international reputations, but perhaps might not have been working to combat human trafficking. It has been a nudge to get them to enact laws, train police, judges, etc. It has not, however, had an impact yet on those countries that do not care at all about their international reputation, and we'll be naming some of those countries shortly, or are engaged in trafficking. It's not a gauge of prevalence. It's important to understand that. So let's talk briefly about what the trafficking tier system is. The department places each country into four tiers, as mandated by the TVPA. This placement is based not on the size of the country's problem, but on the extent of the government's effort to meet the Trafficking Victims Protection Act's minimum standards. In that way, it's a diplomatic tool. It's aiming at moving governments around this issue. So tier one are countries whose government fully meet the Trafficking Victims Protection Act's minimum standards. In other words, are states taking actions to prohibit and punish traffickers? Tier two, countries whose governments do not fully meet the Trafficking Victim Protection Act's minimum standards, but they are making significant efforts to bring themselves into compliance with those standards. After a while, we issued something called the Tier 2 watch list. These are countries whose governments do not fully meet the minimum standards, but they're making some significant efforts, but the absolute number of trafficking victims of severe forms of trafficking is very significant or it's increasing. You can end up on that tier two watch list also if you're failing to provide evidence of increasing efforts to combat severe forms of trafficking. Tier three, this is the list that you don't ever want to be on. These are countries who do not fully meet the minimum standards. They're not making significant efforts to do so. In other words, these are countries that essentially do not care. To give you a sense, for the 2017 period of where countries are falling, we had about 20%. First of all, I should say that if we have 193 member states at the UN, we don't have data on all countries. So the number of countries in 2017 that were tiered were 184. Falling in tier one, we had about 20% of these countries. Falling in tier two, we had 44%. about 24% landed on the Tier 2 watch list. We had between 12 and 13% of countries falling on the Tier 3 list. Tier 3 countries running 4 years straight on that list include Russia, Iran, North Korea, Syria, Venezuela. And you might be thinking, what do all these countries have in common? They have typically very high corruption and intense poor governance. Let's talk briefly about the money that is expended to combat trafficking and by whom. It's important that you understand, as taxpayers, the US government is spending roughly $60 million a year to combat human trafficking around the world. That includes about $16 million from USAID, about $30 million coming out of the State Department, and the balance, $14, $15 million, going to the Department of Labor. When you compare those numbers, $60 million, to the number of victims that we project annually of somewhere between 20 and 40 million, you can see that's not a lot, especially when you think of the $150 billion it's generating. So these funds typically go to countries where we have USAID missions or embassies that oversee their disbursement to partnerships that work on protection, to train emergency service, and to conduct research. At this point, I want to turn to what I have done to combat human trafficking. And it begins with actually research. In 2003 to 2005, I had a grant from the State Department's Office to Combat Trafficking to do research looking at trafficking in and around peacekeeping operations in Bosnia and Kosovo. That grant built off an earlier grant that I had had from the MacArthur Foundation, where I was looking at what had been thought of as a very rosy picture of US-Russian military cooperation in Bosnia. What I found in that initial research for the MacArthur Foundation was that the Russian soldiers were involved in human trafficking. So I went to the State Department and they supported research for a report that was published in 2005 by the Center for Strategic and International Studies. It's called Barracks and Brothels. And it was the result of field visits that I did to Bosnia and Kosovo and interviews with some very brave men who came forward to share with me what was going on inside NATO deployments. Specifically, the trafficking was going on. And in this case, I found that it was not just the Russians that were involved, which was the case, but it was also some US contractors. Now, the report examined the links between peacekeeping operations and the trafficking of women and girls for sexual exploitation. It's important to understand the vast majority of uniformed service members, as well as civilian contractors who support peacekeeping operations, they do so honorably. Tragically, however, international and human rights organizations have documented a disturbing correlation between international deployments and a dramatic rise of the number of trafficked women and girls. Now, peacekeeping operations in the Balkans had the unintended consequence of providing the demand for trafficked females from Eastern Europe and Eurasia for forced prostitution. Thousands of women and girls were trafficked after the deployment of the international force, and at least 10% of them were minors. Now, because human trafficking is a central activity for criminal networks in conflict and post-conflict regions, it poses an intrinsic security threat to those peacekeeping missions. Yet the absence of awareness concerning those links between trafficking and peacekeeping operations is pervasive. Now, let me turn to the policy side of work that I've done, and it was connected to the research. In 2004, the US Department of Defense, NATO, and the UN all took steps to address the role of peacekeeping operations in trafficking. And in 2004, I co-hosted a summit at NATO with all NATO ambassadors on the topic. In that year, these organizations all adopted, quote, zero tolerance policies on trafficking. The prevalence of attitudes, however, indifference, denial, misperception, and even occasionally acceptance, pose enormous challenges to the comprehensive implementation of these anti-trafficking policies. Attitudes and organizational cultures, certainly at the UN, to this very day, are obstacles to change, and they drive the current low level of resources devoted to this problem and the larger issue of sexual exploitation and abuse in humanitarian operations that I'm sure you've read about. Now, I started at USAID in 2010, and the first thing I did was I lobbied my bosses for moving trafficking into my portfolio. It had lived somewhere else at USAID. The second thing I did, which cost no money, is I pressed for a code of conduct for all USAID employees and contractors, because I had done this research and knew that we needed a code of conduct. Number three, I worked with colleagues to create a new policy to guide the $16 million that we were investing. And we drafted a field guide to help staff around the world concretely implement the policy. All of these are online at the UN. Now, soon after arriving at USUN, I did have the opportunity to raise the issue of human trafficking. I found receptivity from Ambassador Power and Ambassador Rice to use what is called the thematic session of the US, that the US would run during its presidency of the Security Council. Every 15 months, the US has the opportunity to be the president of the Security Council. In this case, we had decided to address human trafficking during this thematic session, and it was a topic that had never been discussed in 70 years of UN Security Council meetings. So the morning before Thanksgiving in 2015, that Wednesday morning, I was instructed to find a survivor to brief the Security Council on December 16th. So that means we have exactly 21 days, including going to buy Thanksgiving dinner and cooking the dinner. We needed a trafficked survivor from a conflict zone who could get a US visa, buy a plane ticket, come to New York, and deliver a compelling briefing. So apologetic and rather frantic calls went out to my network. But within days, we had found, turns out it's not that hard to find, a number of candidates. And my team conducted a series of hours-long interviews with these women who had all been enslaved by ISIL or Daesh. We chose Nadia Murad, then 21 years old, who had been enslaved in August 2014 when ISIL overran her community. She does live in Germany, thanks to an excellent resettlement program explicitly devoted to Yazidi women. We had great help from US consular officials in Germany who expedited her visa. And Nadia quickly came to New York with a ticket that was funded by Yazda, the Yazidi NGO that was supporting her at the time. And Nadia described in detail her enslavement and repeated rape to a hushed Security Council and was met with thunderous applause and visibly moved ambassadors. Few could remember a Security Council session as emotional. Now, after her testimony to the council, Nadia's life changed. She was recently awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. She was awarded the Sakharov Prize. She became a goodwill ambassador to the UN in 2016. The story of Nadia's ascent is one of taking an issue that is very broad, human trafficking. It's often not very well understood. And through the power of a particular person's story, making it real. And that's really had, I think, some impact. That said, in UN terms, it was a win on all sorts of levels. There were additional Security Council sessions that were held by the Spanish, by the British. But in reality, the facts are grim. And to this date, no one has been prosecuted from ISIL for their crimes, including genocide. And today, there are still thousands of Yazidi women held captive. So what more could be done? Now, I'm going to interrupt what has been probably a rather gloomy conversation and tell you about something that is quite amazing. Now, first, it's important to understand the paradigms that I've been describing with the dominant paradigm of prosecution. If you recall those numbers of $150 billion being generated, 20 to 40 million victims. And then you look at the data around prosecution and convictions, I would argue we're not doing all that we should be doing. In 2016, for example, we have law enforcement data that show just under 15,000 prosecutions led globally to just over 9,000 convictions. 2017, the number jumped to under 18,000 prosecutions, but it falls in terms of convictions to just over 7,000. When you look at the US, the numbers are even worse. In 2014 and 2015, we had less than 300 convictions. Don't misunderstand me. It's not that I think laws and prosecution are not important. They're critically important, and I'm going to give you the name of an organization that you could support that trains lawyers to do better in terms of prosecution. But I've come to believe that the legal framework only needs to be greatly supplemented. We need to enhance the four P's. That prevention and partnership piece are greatly important, and they need to be expanded in ways to broaden constituencies that know about this issue, care about this issue, and frankly won't stand for trafficking anymore. And that's where I come to the good news in my last remaining moments before we open up for Q&A. I want to tell you that 3 years ago, something amazing happened. In September 2015, we, the global community, 193 countries, agreed on an agenda to make the world, through 2030, a more peaceful, just, and inclusive planet, to radically reduce poverty, and to address climate change, among many other goals. This agenda is called the Sustainable Development Goals, or the SDGs. I encourage you all to get to know them. They are not the creation of a handful of people. They are the response of years of negotiation and engagement with millions of people around the world, especially with young people. This is a paradigm shift in how we think about development, because this applies to all of us. This is not about the global north talking to the global south. This is about recognizing we in the United States are also developing. Now, while this agenda was launched at the UN, it's important for it to have any real impact, it has to be locally owned. You shouldn't think of these as the UN goals, but as our goals or the global goals. And I want to argue that this agenda, rather than just being some faraway development agenda, actually can address many pressing social issues in this and many other countries. It can help shore up support for democracy, dignity, truth, and freedom of expression. These goals are relevant for helping to shore up what is called the liberal world order, and that's all good news. The less good news is that very few people know about the SDGs, but I'm betting that in the coming year, there are going to be a lot more of you hearing about the SDGs, in part because in 2019, both in July and September, there's going to be heads of state meeting. And when heads of states gather, it is an action-forcing mechanism to raise awareness. Now, how does any of this relate to what I've been talking about? In a number of ways. First of all, you should know that we, the international community, in a number of the goals, explicitly agreed to eliminate all forms of violence against women and girls in the public and private spheres, including trafficking, to take immediate and effective measures to eradicate forced labor and modern slavery and human trafficking, and to end the abuse, exploitation, and trafficking and all forms of violence against and torture of children. So we have already agreed to this agenda, and it's a rallying point for a lot of us. But I think we also need to, and I want to address the young people who are here and who are listening, I think we need to grow the generation that demands and delivers the implementation of the Sustainable Development Goals. This is a generation born after 1980 that have particular characteristics that are amenable to the SDGs. They have native fluency in innovation and technology that can be used to combat human trafficking. They have a lot of empathy and attitudes towards diversity and inclusion, particularly around gender. There's a lot of antipathy around corruption. They're interested in ethically sourced and environmentally sound products, and they're concerned about climate change. So how do we broaden constituencies concerned about trafficking? So what I call Cohort 2030 will be the generation that demands the end of human trafficking. You can ask me more questions about Cohort 2030 and the specific strategies around this. You should know it's a collaborative effort with the Rockefeller Foundation and an organization called the International Youth Foundation, and of course with Carnegie Mellon University. So what can you do? It's very important that you understand that there are ways in which you can also be engaged. Number one, you can educate yourself and recognize the signs of trafficking if you see them. Are you encountering a young person who has no freedom of movement, their passport has been taken away? You can be conscious consumers and visit something called knowthechain.org and find out where the products that you're wearing are sourced and whether there's slavery in that supply chain. You can press companies that you invest in to make sure that their supply chains are free of slavery. You should know the hotline that has been set up in the United States, 1-888-373-7888, should you ever encounter a victim of human trafficking. There's also an email address that's pretty simple, help@humantraffickinghotline.org. And if for any reason there were a trafficking victim listening, of course this applies to you. Now, you can also donate, and I want to suggest there are a couple organizations that are very respected, each of which do different things to combat human trafficking. One's called Not For Sale. It's at notforsalecampaign.org, and it runs programs for survivors teaching new skills for reintegration. There's another one called ECPAT, ECPAT.org, for End Child Prostitution and Trafficking, with a particular focus on ending child exploitation. There's something called the Freedom Fund, thefreedomfund.org, which is a leading fund that works in the field, doing very successful work on reducing human trafficking. They've led a really important effort around reducing trafficking in the Thai fishing industry, for example, but also in India. And then there's something called the Human Trafficking Legal Center. It's at htlegalcenter.org. It's devoted to training lawyers in how to prosecute trafficking cases successfully. It's run by my former pro bono attorney, and I can tell you she is devoted to training these lawyers and getting those prosecution and conviction numbers up. The other thing you can do as Mainers is you can call your representatives, your senators, and your congressional representatives, and urge them to reauthorize the Trafficking Victims Protection Act. It's up for reauthorization, but they need to know that this is an important issue, that it's important to Mainers, and it's important that it gets reauthorized. And with that, I thank you for your attention, and I look forward to your questions.
My question is, are there other legislation that we need? Is the problem with the prosecutions or that the laws are not strong enough to really combat these issues?
I think the legislation that is in place is good. I think it's important, and Senator Corker did this. It's very important that when the State Department is putting countries into tiers, that there's no politicization process. So how do countries end up in different tiers? Number one, there's a lot of information that comes from the embassies and the missions that we all support with our taxpayer dollars. That information is funneled into the State Department, into the Office to Combat and Monitor Trafficking. But as many of you who've served in government know, there can be bureaucratic struggles. And some of the regional bureaus may decide, I don't want my country or my region placed on that tier three list. And so they will lobby the Secretary of State, who's the ultimate decider, to either move their country up, either to tier two or tier two watch list. The countries themselves may be lobbying inside Washington to not end up on that list. So we need to be very vigilant, and I suppose we could have additional pieces of legislation to make sure that that's not the case. I think in general, we need more funding to combat human trafficking generally. And so I think that there was legislation passed which asks other countries to put money into a fund that is run out of the U.S. And I think that it's problematic. It's difficult to ask other countries to put money in a fund that's run out of the U.S. I think we as taxpayers should be upping our game and supporting additional funding, because I worry that the other countries just are not going to deliver.
One question here, I think maybe a clarification of something was on your in your presentation. Is there a chain.org or like organization for products other than clothing? Was the one here just for clothing, or was it for everything?
No, thechain.org looks at a number of different supply chains. It's important to understand that clothing is for certain one area that is problematic, candy, chocolate, cocoa, electronics, food, meaning fish, but also one of the most famous cases involved labor trafficking of tomato pickers in Florida that were living under slave labor conditions. So there are a number of ways that we as consumers are confronting or ignoring trafficking in chains. Now, I do think there are ways to make some of these websites easier to follow, but I think it's an extremely important aspect, and I think maybe cohort 2030, as they become even more tech savvy, are going to be really helpful in trying to make it as easy as possible to know when you're at the grocery store, what's the probability, for example, that some product you're buying has involved slave labor.
You mentioned in your presentation that the fourth P, partnership, was subtracted from the State Department website. There's a question here on, you know, why was it subtracted, if you know, and what we can do to get it back, in general, what differences are there in the U.S. response to trafficking in the Trump administration compared to earlier administrations?
So the fact that the fourth P partnership disappeared, I don't know, but I suspect it did actually have to do with the fact that Secretary Clinton was the one who was advocating for that fourth P, and that Secretary Pompeo took it out. That doesn't mean that the Office to Combat and Monitor Trafficking at State or those at USAID don't understand the importance of partnership. These are very professional, very highly trained, skilled diplomats and development experts. They certainly understand the role that development plays, I mean, that partnership plays. I also note that in the Sustainable Development Goals that we all agreed to, what is the 17th goal is exactly about partnership. So the best practice these days is understanding that partnership is fundamentally critical. I think it could be argued that under this administration, U.S. global leadership on a variety of issues has diminished, declined, in some case, just disappeared. In the case of human trafficking, as I noted, this is by and large a nonpartisan issue. And so when the trafficking report was released this year, the president's daughter, Ivanka Trump, was there to talk about it, as well as Secretary Pompeo. They did finally announce and then confirm a ambassador at large to combat human trafficking. So we have leadership in that office in place. That's extremely important. We can't tell if there's mostly rhetoric. I will note that this administration is at the UN trying to get the word gender taken out of all UN documents, which makes it a little bit difficult in some cases to work on gender-based violence, which is, of course, a piece of human trafficking. So there's sort of two steps forward, one step back. I'm actually quite concerned that Senator Corker is leaving in December. He's been a huge champion inside the Senate. He's made it really a centerpiece. We need leadership in Congress to step forward on this issue.
Thank you very much. This one I find really interesting because I hadn't thought of it myself. Compare trafficking with other forms of kidnapping. The law, you know, when someone gets kidnapped, it becomes a huge deal sometimes. The laws, enforcement, punishment. I mean, is it similar, different?
So I'm not a lawyer. I usually rely on lawyers when we get into distinctions. But I will tell you that, in general, kidnapping is not necessarily it involves force, but it could involve fraud. It doesn't necessarily involve coercion, and it's not necessarily for the purposes of exploitation. There's not the kind of internationally agreed protocols around kidnapping. There's not the same kind of legislation. Kidnapping could be a part of trafficking, but it's not the sum total. And of course, we talked about the different kinds of trafficking, whether for forced labor, debt bondage, sex trafficking, that go well beyond.
Please give examples of how the tier ranking system can affect diplomatic relations. I mean, is this so far down on the list that we don't care, or does it sometimes rise to the top?
So as I noted before, so initially, if you take yourselves back to 2000, there is no tier ranking. There are not a lot of countries that necessarily have laws on the books. In 2000, we also have this Palermo Protocol. We have this international definition that we've agreed to, and over the coming years, more and more countries are signing on to the convention. Or the protocol. As you do that, you're also beginning to develop domestic law around this issue. If you're a country that generally cares about your international reputation, it's a nudge to action and you begin to develop legislation. If you're a country that really cares about your reputation and you fall on tier two or tier two watch list, you care a lot. And it can happen because for a variety of reasons, it's played oftentimes a role in our relationship with India, for example. In the case of Malaysia in 2015, there was a question of whether there was politicization about where Malaysia was going to fall. But for those countries that don't care, the Venezuelas, the Syrias, we have yet to figure out how to address the issue there. So for that relatively large group of countries that are in the middle that do care about their reputation, they don't want to end up on tier two watch list. They certainly don't want to end up on tier three. I had the experience of traveling to Bosnia at one point when the issue in June of the trafficking report had Bosnia on a tier they didn't want to land on, and they worked extremely hard by September, because there is a period where you issue the report and then countries can make clear what they're doing to address this issue. By September, they move off.
Yeah, I would ask the same question in slightly different fashion. I know when I was in government working issues of non-proliferation, weapons of mass destruction, when something would be raised with respect to a particular country, it'd always be, you know, and we wanted some action taken. It was, well, you know, we'd love to, you know, be harder on this, but we have this other interest that overrides what your concerns are. Do you see the same thing in these areas?
Sure. Listen, I mean, as everyone knows, foreign policy and the conduct of foreign policy is complicated. It can be inconsistent. Generally, there are a lot of us who work on human rights who, if we're working in government, we're struggling to make the argument that the violation of human rights are actually a security issue and that people should be concerned about it, rather than say, but we have these other issues that we want to work on. You know, a lot of this comes down to personalities and the ability to work inside, for example, the State Department and bring along the assistant secretary for whatever region or the ambassador from whatever country to get them to be champions and understand that this is part of their mandate, rather than to set this up as an either or. How do we figure out what is the diplomatic strategy where I can get the ambassador on board, I can get the assistant secretary on board, I can get the secretary on board, and we can all make progress on whatever trade issue we're doing, but also address these issues. It's not easy, but I think that if you come in not with a combative, you're part of the problem attitude, but, I mean, who wants to be an ambassador to a country and not be a champion of combating human trafficking? And the State Department has awards that reward ambassadors who are also working on these issues.
Let me press even a little further on this one. Do you know if there have ever been any cases where the U.S. has instituted embargoes or other punitive measures just because of trafficking?
Yes, there is language in the legislation where if you land on the trafficking in Tier 3 X number of times, you are meant to be sanctioned. And this is where the rubber meets the road. The number of countries that end up being sanctioned are oftentimes one where it's relatively easy for us to sanction, that there aren't other number of issues that are occurring. So there are loopholes, although I think there are people who argue that the way the trafficking sanctions are written, it is actually a tool and a hook. And I'll note, as you're going to be hosting in December, one of the key players for the Magnitsky Act and the global Magnitsky Act, the use of sanctions to target human rights abusers is one of the best, newest tools in the toolkit. And it is gaining ground globally. There are more countries that are adopting similar legislation, and I think you're going to see, like the trafficking laws that proliferated in other countries, you're going to see more of this use of the Global Magnitsky Act, targeting issues of corruption and human rights abuse.
Well, good news, I would say. Let's switch from government now to civil society. Someone has a question, do human rights NGOs, non-governmental organizations, include trafficking in their agenda and research?
So human rights NGOs are like any organization. They're very varied. There's some organizations, some of which I named, that do nothing but work on human trafficking. And I think that, for example, the Freedom Fund would consider itself a human rights organization, but also it is exclusively focused on human trafficking. The large, big, well-known human rights organization, like Human Rights Watch, not only has worked on human trafficking, but the pro bono attorney that I was mentioning before, who now runs the Human Trafficking Legal Center, did groundbreaking work at Human Rights Watch on trafficking in Bosnia and Kosovo. Amnesty International has also looked at it. The Human Rights First, which is one of the big, one of the large human rights organizations in the U.S., has had a program on human trafficking. I urge everyone, you can support organizations to take up this issue. It is oftentimes, frankly, underfunded.
As are a lot of things. Someone points out here that the Maine State Advisory Committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission did a hearing and report on these type of issues just recently, and it's available online. And then this ties in with another question. Do you know the scope of the problem and what individual states are doing as opposed to the national government?
So my understanding is that typically in the state of Maine, you have between 200 and 300 cases of trafficking annually. There was a survey done of law enforcement officers in Maine, and they came across nearly 40% of those that were surveyed had seen a trafficking case within the last year. There were two issues that I think deserve initial or additional focus. Was that, and this gets to that question of human rights NGOs, nearly three quarters of the law enforcement officers could not tell you the name of a organization in Maine addressing human trafficking, so that needs to change. But also, less than 50% of these law enforcement officers believed that their departments were well prepared to address issues relating to trafficking of minors. So additional training needs to happen on that front.
Here's a question. In market terms, trafficking is a function of supply and demand. Can you tell us on the supply side where most of the women and children victims are sourced? Is it from war, extreme poverty, et cetera? Do we know the numbers? Also, are most of them used in the sex trade, manufacturing, agriculture? Where's the biggest?
If you picture a map of the world, and if you look at over time, there are different ways in which trafficking trends occur. So after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there were a lot of women and girls trafficked out of what is the former Soviet Union to parts of Eastern and Western Europe. That was a very large trafficking route. I talked about the routes from East Central Europe to Bosnia and Kosovo after the appearance of international peacekeepers. Counter-trafficking organizations have identified a large trail between Nepal to Qatar, building the football or soccer stadiums for the 2022 World Cup. So there's been a lot of focus on that. There's been a lot of focus on the fishing industry. So it depends on where you're looking, at what time. There's certainly, you see spikes. And you see law enforcement and campaigns around. In New York City, you can see ads about Qatar being a destination place for human trafficking.
We always change gears a lot here because the questions are all over the place. But here's one I also find personally very interesting.
George, can I say one thing? On the supply versus demand side, I actually did some work in Russia looking at survey work, trying to identify the number of victims in Russia, females, 18 to 36, who had been trafficked. I think there's a lot of work that can be done that needs to be supported of surveys where you can use the survey to get a good population-based estimate of the number of victims that are survivors that are out there and then drive services to them. So I think there's work still to be done on this.
Then let's switch to what happens when these cases are successfully pursued. Someone asks, when traffickers are caught and successfully prosecuted, such as when the case that you cited of the Indian pipefitters and welders. And there's a settlement. Do some of these people get some of the money since they were trafficked, or does it all go into the pocket of somebody else?
No, I think, you know, the lawyers that are working on combating human trafficking, these are generally not people who are looking to get rich off of trafficking survivors. So the money very much does go to the victims. The interesting case of diplomats that have been tried, for example, in the Southern District of New York, who were UN diplomats to the UN, who still owe money to the trafficking survivors. We have a number of cases where the courts have found in favor, and the money hasn't been delivered. And there are ways in which the State Department could be pressing either those individuals or those states from which those diplomats merge to actually pay up.
Do traffickers use cryptocurrency to evade detection? Is it going to be more common?
Not an expert on cryptocurrency, but I think we can assume that some of the, because of cryptocurrency being hard to trace, that it is very advantageous to those engaged in illicit crime. There is a worldwide movement around transparency and accountability and people wanting to have sunshine shown on these kinds of things. So I don't know. I think it's going to be a struggle.
Here's one on whether it's a national or international prosecution. Are trafficking prosecutions mostly done within a country? And how do you prosecute across borders? Is there a mechanism?
Well, again, I think one of the most are done within. There are a lot of countries where somebody flees and in the country to which they flee, they're not interested. It's extremely important that in, for example, the United States or in Europe, there are a lot of the prosecutions are happening, that they're taken to conclusion and that the country in which a trafficker flees to is willing to bring that person back for trial.
I'm going to ask a couple more questions. I think we're about out of time, but I think we got a few more minutes here. Nadia Murad's ordeal was at the hands of ISIL, a political terrorist group. What percentage of trafficking is due to such militaristic organizations, and what percentage is entirely commercial?
So as I suggested, there's a lot of debate, discussion of what the percentages are. Typically, I think the argument is that in some cases this is politicized. I think you see over time in the United States, if it's a Democrat in power, there is a tendency to increasingly focus or be open to focusing on the prevalence of labor trafficking. And so that's what we really had during the Obama years, is there was an increase in a focus on how is labor trafficking involved versus in the Bush administration when there was almost exclusively a focus on sex trafficking. It's very difficult to tell exactly the percentages break down. What we know is that Boko Haram is involved in human trafficking. Obviously, ISIL is involved. There have been arguments that Al-Qaeda was involved in human trafficking. I don't have the firm numbers. The Taliban is involved in the trafficking of boys. So in any kind of criminal organization, you should figure that trafficking in some form is going to be part of the book of business, if you will.
Then let me end on one that's a very broad question here. How many of the 17 sustainable development goals are reasonably possible to achieve?
It's easy to be skeptical about an aspirational agenda. To be honest, this is frankly all up to all of us. The reason why we have any optimism about the SDGs is because we lived through their predecessor, the Millennium Development Goals, which ran from 2000 to 2015, which ended up reducing the percentage of those living in extreme poverty from, let's say, according to the World Bank, 26% in 1990. Down to 10% by 2015. So we see this enormous collective action among donors, governments, that is possible. If you say it's impossible to end human trafficking and nobody is joining you, then it's going to be impossible to end human trafficking. I want to note that in Goal 16, there is a commitment to reduce all forms of violence. This includes urban violence and guns. I think you can see there is a cohort 2030 in the United States. There are Parkland students that have gone across the country advocating. So you can be skeptical. I leave it in the hands in part to cohort 2030. Again, those under born after 1980, they have the most to gain or lose from how much is implemented by 2030. They will take this agenda forward into 2040, 2050. Not a lot of us will be around. So in a lot of ways, it is on their shoulders. We will help in any way that we can. But we urge them not to be skeptical and not to be defeatist. This is a very optimistic agenda. It's a nonpartisan agenda. It's been adopted and blessed by millions and millions of people. And implementing it is in part about asking your governor or your mayor, not necessarily at the federal level, to get involved. We see cities around the world stepping forward. So watch that space.
I want to thank you very, very much.